How now, Dow?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Steve Chiatakis. What does a jump of 497 points mean? And what comes now? I was just surfing the blogs and news sites reading headlines like this one. Is the worst over? Big Wall Street rally offers hint of hope. Well, it's hard to fault some wishful thinking when the Dow surges 7%, but it turns out that it's also hard to resist the temptation to take a little of that money off the table after the stock market's biggest advance in almost half a year. The Dow has dipped 103 points so far this morning, giving back 1.3% of yesterday's rally. The Nasdaq's off by 1.5%. The S&P 500 has retreated nearly 1.2%. London's FTSE is also down, but Frankfurt's DAX is holding on to a slight gain. Issue one on Capitol Hill today, the big bonuses that went to those executives at AIG. At the same time, there's word 9 of the top 10 bonus recipients at the struggling insurance giant have agreed to give their bonuses back. That's according to the New York Attorney General. As Tamara Keith reports, Andrew Cuomo is reporting some success in his fight to recover that money.
Of the $165 million in bonuses handed out earlier this month, Cuomo says AIG employees have now agreed to return about $50 million of it.
And I applaud them, and I hope the other employees will follow their lead.
And the New York Attorney General appears to be reversing the hard stance he took last week on naming names of those who took bonuses.
If a person returns the money, I don't believe there's a public interest in releasing their name.
Cuomo says he hopes to eventually recover $80 million. The rest was paid to employees outside of the U.S., including those in AIG's financial products division in London. This morning, both Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner and Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke will be on Capitol Hill answering questions about the AIG bailout. Geithner will no doubt be grilled about what he knew about the bonuses and when. In Washington, I'm Tamara Keith for Marketplace.
By the way, the Treasury Secretary's answer to things like the AIG fiasco likely includes sweeping new powers. Geithner is expected to present a sneak peek at new legislation the Obama administration is planning to send to Capitol Hill. It reportedly would allow Geithner to seize a wide array of financial institutions if their collapse would damage the U.S. economy. Watch out, Wall Street. The potential takeover list could include investment firms, hedge funds, and even big insurance companies like you-know-who. Walmart is trying to discount what might be the nation's biggest ever discrimination lawsuit. The nation's largest employer is off to a federal appeals court in San Francisco today. But the question before the court isn't whether the retail giant paid female employees as much as male employees. Walmart is disputing whether 2 million women can sue an employer in a single lawsuit. Here's Amanda Aronchik with more.
For so many plaintiffs to go against a single employer is, well, unprecedented. Ted Boutrous is Walmart's lead counsel on the appeal. He says that if the class action proceeds, Walmart won't get to defend itself against individual charges. He calls it a trial by statistics.
We have a tradition in this country that individuals get their day in court. Class actions are an exception to that that need to be used carefully so as not to defeat people's rights.
Deborah Smith is a senior staff attorney with Equal Rights Advocates. She argues that Walmart's discrimination is systemic.
It's exactly the type of case that the federal judiciary envisioned being a class action. It's David versus Goliath, you know, it's classic.
Smith says that if each woman were forced to bring her own suit, no one could possibly afford it. The original case has now been in the courts for over 8 years, and it's not getting any cheaper. I'm Amanda Aronchik for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Morning Report for Tuesday, March 24th at marketplace.org. Bankruptcy filings are on the rise again in U.S. courtrooms despite a 2005 reform law designed to cut down on the number of people seeking bankruptcy protection. There was an initial fall-off in bankruptcies after the reform became law, but the economy has brought bankruptcy rates almost back to pre-reform levels. As a result, reforms are back on the congressional agenda, as John Dimsdale reports from Washington.
The four-year-old reforms imposed a strict means test on bankruptcy filers. Debtors have to submit income tax forms, credit card bills, and lists of expenditures. Fail the means test and the government won't protect you from creditors. Some, like Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, a Rhode Island Democrat, say those reforms favored banks at the expense of consumers. He's sponsoring a bill that targets credit card companies.
Through interest rates and through fees and through penalties, they are exacting interest rates now that are really unconscionable.
The bill prevents lenders who charge ultra-high interest from collecting those debts in bankruptcy. But that would make those loans even more expensive, says the Heritage Foundation's David John.
If these debts are just automatically gone, that adds yet another level of risk to these loans.
John will have a chance to tell Senator Whitehouse what he thinks of the new Senate bankruptcy reform bill when he testifies at a Senate hearing later this morning. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
As the government works on a financial do-over, that is, getting banks to lend again, some other banks in the world are doing just fine, thank you. Today, the Bank of China said its earnings last year grew by 14%. And as Western peers struggle, Chinese banks smell a bit of what we'll call China opportunity. Here's Marketplace's Scott Tong from Shanghai.
Bank of China and the other banks reporting earnings this week benefit from what some call the Great Financial Wall of China. By decree, it's hard for foreign money to rush in and hard for Chinese money to go out. So Chinese banks largely stayed out of the water of toxic assets. Matthew Phillips is with PricewaterhouseCoopers in Shanghai.
They were not heavy investors in toxic assets, subprime derivatives, CDOs, CBOs, etc. There are regulatory limitations on them doing that, and also they exercise a significant level of caution at the direction of the Chinese regulators.
In part because party officials appoint the top bankers. In a new survey, Phillips found almost 70% of Chinese financial institutions plan to expand overseas this year. The main reason is their corporate clients are packing their suitcases, shopping for mines in Australia, oil in Russia, and someday perhaps a well-known car brand on the block. In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
A bill before Congress right now would make it easier for workers to join unions. The Employee Free Choice Act would allow unions to sign up workers and bypass the current system of secret balloting. Most businesses oppose the bill, but a compromise might be on the way, spearheaded by three major retailers. Marketplace's Janet Babin has more from North Carolina Public Radio.
The compromise comes from Starbucks, Whole Foods, and Costco. It would eliminate two key provisions of the Employee Free Choice Act. First, it would still require secret elections to create a union. And there would be no binding arbitration during contract disputes. Most unions have snubbed this new alternative. Mary Beth Maxwell is with American Rights at Work.
This proposal is no compromise. It does not fix fundamental problems.
Most business leaders are limp on the proposal, too. They don't like that it would set a specific time frame for union elections and that it would impose stricter penalties for businesses that violate labor laws. Organizers say all this opposition is a sign of true compromise. Eileen O'Connor's an attorney who represents Costco, Starbucks, and Whole Foods.
It isn't really surprising that both sides are attacking it, but what we'd like to do is open a dialogue instead of the polarizing debate that's been going on.
Business leaders don't think Congress has the votes to pass the bill. But with President Obama's support, unions may have the wind at their back here. That could be why they're reluctant to cede any ground and why the three retailers scrambled to come up with a plan B. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
20 years ago today, an oil tanker called the Exxon Valdez hit a reef and spilled nearly 11 million gallons of oil into Alaska's Prince William Sound. Since then, the oil industry has ramped up safety measures, but now a proposal to drill in the Arctic has some experts worried about future accidents. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Caitlin Carroll reports.
Billions of fish died. Millions of dollars went into the environmental cleanup. And now the big question is, could it happen again? Richard Berkowitz is from the Transportation Institute, a shipping industry association. He says there are lots of new laws in the books at American ports and plenty of incentive for oil companies to toe the line.
If they bring a vessel that is not up to snuff, it'll get held up. And if you hold up a ship, that's, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars a day that will be lost.
Berkowitz says many supertankers have converted to a double hull design that protects the ship from spills, and now they use global navigation systems. Environmental groups say safety has improved, but worry that new exploration could lead the tankers into more dangerous waters. Oceana's Jeffrey Short says a new proposal to drill in the Arctic could pose big risks.
Nobody knows how to clean up an oil spill in the presence of ice or when it's dark 24 hours for months on end.
That's just one of the points Short will make at a House hearing on offshore drilling today. I'm Caitlin Carroll for Marketplace.
The outlook for British manufacturers is grim. Economists expect the sector to shed more than 140,000 jobs this year. But in the country that kicked off the Industrial Revolution, the business of making things could yet have a future. From London, Christopher Worth has more.
Brompton Bicycle has been manufacturing folding bikes in its small factory in West London since the 1970s.
By manufacture, I mean manufacture. You know, bits of metal come in, we bend them, we punch holes in them.
Emerson Roberts is Brompton's marketing manager. He says the company has grown from just a handful of people when it started to employing almost 100 today. It takes in about $12 million annually. And Roberts is ambitious for the future.
The plan this year is to grow sales by 25%.
Brompton is one of those rare success stories. When it opened its doors 3 decades ago, manufacturing accounted for 35% of Britain's GDP. Today, it's less than 15%. Britain has become a service economy with financial services at its core. Steve Hughes is an economic advisor with the British Chambers of Commerce.
Narrow reliance on financial services has been a weakness of the UK economy, and if you want growth and stability in the long term, there needs to be some kind of rebalance and redress within it.
Many in Britain hope that such a rebalancing could mean a much bigger role for manufacturing. The fact that the pound has recently plunged steeply against foreign currencies is just what's needed to give that trend a boost.
What's supposed to happen is that as the price of our exported goods are cheaper to our trading partners, then sales will obviously increase.
British producers also become more competitive at home as imports become more expensive. Of course, a weaker pound can't guarantee success in the current economy. British manufacturing dropped more than 5% by the end of last year. But back over at the bicycle factory, Brompton can already thank those lower exchange rates.
In parts of Asia and in the US, our sales are very strong. And in the UK, compared with last year, they are very much higher.
Other manufacturers in Britain would also love to boost their sales. Bosses and labor unions have recently called for massive government investment in a sector they hope can pull Britain out of its current economic funk. In London, this is Christopher Worth for Marketplace.
So far, so good for the Obama administration's new plan to rid the banks of their poisons. Wall Street was clearly dazzled, which may be just what the doctors ordered. Specifically, a couple of economic experts, Drs. George Akerlof and Robert Shiller, are the authors of a new book, Animal Spirits, in which they explore how human psychology drives the economy. Welcome to the program, both of you.
Well, thank you for having us.
Bob, it's a pleasure.
So let me ask you, I guess I am one of those prophets of gloom and doom that everybody talks about when it comes to the economy lately. What's your message to me? Is there any way that my message might help improve the economic situation, Mr. Shiller?
That's putting a lot on you. I think the media have an important role, but they're not the cause of this problem and they're not the solution. We need real government action. We need stronger fiscal policy to get us out of this crisis and get our confidence back.
And the government can actually sway public opinion, if you will, about what our situation is?
The fundamental problem we have today is that everyone thinks we're in a bad economy. So that means employers don't want to hire people and people don't want to spend, and it's a vicious circle. The kind of thing that the Obama administration is doing and Congress is doing is on the right track. It's just not big enough yet.
And why does the government, Mr. Akerlof, need to get out in front of this more than anyone else?
Well, when people have good psychology and they're over-exuberant, then the government should be careful that it has good regulations. When the story turns and people have bad expectations, then it's up to the government to be sure that people have what everybody needs. What everybody needs and wants is a job. What businesses and consumers need is they need credit. And so the government should fulfill those two roles.
And what should the government do going forward, Professor Shiller?
Well, I've already said that they should be more stimulative than they are. On top of that, we really need to think over the next 5 or 10 years about how to respond to this kind of crisis. We had built a financial and economic system that was vulnerable. We often compare it to the Great Depression, not to say it's going to be so bad, but looking back at that period, it generated a lot of legislation and a lot of new institutions then that responded to that crisis. I think for years going forward, we are going to be responding further to this crisis, and I'm hopeful that we'll make positive and solid improvements in the way our economy functions.
Robert Shiller, George Akerlof, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon. Did you hear J.P. Morgan is going ahead and buying a couple of new private jets? Check out what Scott Jagow has to say at marketplace.org.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.